This is the news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, May 30th. We'll be discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times, Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. We'll check in with CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent, our Statehouse reporter Katie Lannon, and we'll speak with CAI's Gilda Geist. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. The Memorial Day holiday weekend is a time to remember those who gave their life in service to protect this country. It is also, for many, the big marker of summer's imminent arrival. As we came out of the long holiday weekend on Tuesday, unexpected news overtook Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket just as the islands were getting back to work. Federal agents came to the islands and arrested some 40 people accused of violating immigration law. There's a lot to unpack, both in what we know about what happened and in its impact on the local communities, the questions it leaves behind. We're joined now by Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hi, Sam.
Good morning, Steve.
And also with us, Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current, which posted some riveting video online. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
I'm going to ask each of you about how this started for you and your communities. Let me start with you, Sam. When did word start to get out that something unusual was happening, and what was it that you heard?
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. Memorial Day weekend kind of coming to an end, and we're going into a new week. I was, you know, feeling overwhelmed just coming out of the long weekend and started getting impounded with calls from residents. There were posts on social media. And what we saw were work vans getting pulled over on vineyard roads. Several instances. We had reporters actually at two instances. But what we heard from the reports that people gave us and from our reporters, it appeared that people were pulled over. They were asked for some kind of paperwork. Some were actually let go from what we were told. Others kind of detained, put into unmarked cars. And really, I think the sticking point here, these are kind of masked federal officials. It was led, we later learned, by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. But it was, they had kind of FBI and DEA written on their vests, but they were masked men. And yeah, so throughout the morning, we just heard these reports and we sent our reporters out there to see what we could find. And yeah, it was wild.
Hmm. Jason, how about on Nantucket? How did this first present? How did news kind of come into the newsroom about this?
Yeah, pretty similar to what Sam just described here on Nantucket. We started getting messages from residents in the community asking if ICE was here. You know, there was cars being pulled over right around 7 a.m. Tuesday morning. My phone started going off with, you know, dozens of messages. Is this real? Is this happening? You know, so we went out. And it was similar to what Sam described. Cars were being pulled over by unmarked cars, agents with masks, some wearing FBI vests, others from other agencies, pulling over vehicles. We spoke to one woman who was just sort of left on the side of the road in the passenger seat of a vehicle. The two men she had been riding with to work had been taken into custody. She was left behind and was waiting to be picked up by a friend. And this happened all around the Mid-Island area. And sort of as this was unfolding, we knew that, you know, it was pretty clear what was happening. This was an immigration enforcement operation at a larger scale than what had happened previously last fall. And, you know, we went down to the Coast Guard station figuring that that is where they would be taking these individuals. And it was. And what we eventually saw by Tuesday afternoon was 12 people in, you know, shackles and life jackets be brought out from the Coast Guard station to a Coast Guard patrol boat, the Hammerhead, and they were loaded up onto the deck of that boat and taken away to the mainland.
I'm thinking about for months now, I think most of our newsrooms have been hearing rumors on different days like, oh, ICE is going to be performing some kind of operation in our area. People have been on edge for a long time. To have this suddenly unfold in front of everybody is a very public thing. They're on on the roads, as you say, pulling over cars. They themselves are wearing masks and they're in unmarked cars. Just the kind of fear that this presents to the community after being the community on edge for this for so long. Sam, can you talk a little bit about it must have really changed the tenor of the island that day and the repercussions coming after, obviously, but really that day right now.
Yeah, we've done some really, what I would say, strong reporting, talking to folks in the Brazilian community on the island, you know, who are, when Trump was elected, were really scared. There was a day, I can't remember now, but I believe in February, when there was this rumor that ICE would be on the island. And it was wild. The entire island felt like it shut down. Steamship boats were empty. A lot of workers come over on the ferries. Those were empty. We heard, you know, construction sites. People just didn't show up to work. And that was the same. The kind of the repercussions from this felt the same in the days afterwards. But really, yeah, we spoke to some families, some in the Brazilian community who are just saying, you know, everyone is just scared after this. You know, we come to the island because we're kind of escaping violence, corruption in Brazil, and we just want to be here to work. Yeah, some, you know, maybe 10% or a few, you know, some are criminals and maybe, you know, we want them out of their community as well, is what they were telling us. But the majority, the vast majority, just want to be here to work, and to, you know, to have a good life, to have access to a good hospital. Yeah.
Jason, I want to talk a little bit about one of the problems or one of the information gaps that really developed here is that people had no idea what was happening. And even after it played out, Immigration Customs Enforcement released a very vague kind of press release saying they had arrested about 40 people. They alleged that two of them had criminal records. You think they just took a large number of people off the islands and kind of didn't identify them at all publicly. I know that you guys have done some work to figure out who these people were on Nantucket. Can you talk a little bit about how you're trying to piece together the information about who the people were and how they were selected? I mean, it seems like it was almost random road checks at certain points.
Yeah, so it was very different, I think, than the operation that happened in the fall last year where you had, you know, five people arrested. They were all named by ICE. The charges against them were described, the allegations of, you know, sort of criminal histories and incidents that had happened on the island. In this case, as you said, you know, the ICE put out a press release saying 40 people, and I do believe that number of 40 includes Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, and I believe some arrests that were made in Hyannis. But they didn't specify, you know, so they didn't break it down. And you're right, they did not identify the names of these people. They did say that two of the 40 had some sort of criminal history, including gang affiliation or sexual assault, but the other 38, there was sort of no description of what, you know, what they were targeted for, or if this was just a random sweep of people and that, you know, stops were being made at random. You know, we talked to one person on Nantucket who, you know, is a U.S. citizen, Caucasian male, who was pulled over by ICE, and, you know, they were asking where he was going and where he was coming from, and then just said, sorry, we got the wrong guy, and sped off. You know, so in the aftermath, you're right, it is, we're kind of left wondering, you know, who are these people and why were they targeted? Why were they, you know, some were pulled over, some were arrested at their residence. We were able to identify three of the 12 people so far. One of them had just started work at a popular island restaurant called Crew. People know Nantucket probably know that that's located on Strait Wharf. It's one of the most popular restaurants on Nantucket. He had just started his job. His name's Manfredo Felipe Castanon Perez. He's from Guatemala, had just arrived on the island. We spoke to his sister, who told us that, you know, he had a work permit but was not in the country legally. And he was arrested at his apartment where he was renting on Nantucket. His sister said that they were looking for other people, but took him into custody when they found him there. Two other people were, you know, in the construction trades. We spoke to their niece and cousin who said, you know, these guys have no criminal records. They were just, you know, hard workers at, you know, working construction on the island, and were pulled over and taken into custody. They're originally from Mexico and had been living and working on Nantucket for about 2 years before this happened.
I want to say that ICE, of course, is saying that these people are here illegally. Their operation is legal in that regard. It's carrying out the law here, and that some of these people had criminal records, and what they're doing with this operation is making our community safer. There were a lot of, we heard a lot from officials after this, you know, local representatives of the Cape and Islands, also even Governor Healey weighing in, and our congressperson Keating weighing in here as well. Everybody really almost uniformly pointing to questions about due process, I think. Sam, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and not just due process, but you know, answers why and who. I think, as Jason was saying, generally when ICE makes these arrests, it comes with a kind of a press release with all this identification and why they targeted this person. But there's been just a vacuum of information there. All we know is two of these roughly 40, as they've said, what they have done. So Maura Healey kind of had a press conference where she said, yeah, well, this is kind of crazy that we don't know. We want answers as to why ICE targeted these folks. We also heard our faith community, 20 leaders in, kind of across the island's faith community, sent out a letter saying they felt like due process was just ignored here, and they felt like these were random targeted events where people just pulled out of their cars, and they were really kind of criticizing the federal government for doing this. And I think a lot of the criticism, too, is over that these were masked federal agents. Generally, there's no kind of humanity there. And I think it raised a lot of questions of how can you trust someone who's arresting you that has a face mask and might not be identifying themselves. And there's been a lot of pushback. We wrote a story about a guy who confronted the ICE officials making these arrests. His video has kind of gone viral, and he was just demanding, you know, a little extreme, but he was demanding answers. Why are you here? Why are you targeting these individuals? And that video, I think a lot of people have responded to that saying, yeah, maybe it was a little extreme, but like we feel what he's saying.
Jason, on the island there, what kind of reaction here is? Is there support for the ICE enforcement? Is there? I know it's varied, but also support from the community, for the immigrant community. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I think there's obviously, you know, these actions, you know, it plays into the whole debate over immigration, political affiliation, you know, and I think there's a lot of sort of shock at, you know, this happening, sort of fear in the community, you know, similar to what Sam described, where, you know, the streets that are typically, you know, clogged with traffic, you know, were, you know, the car, there was no traffic really at all the day following, you know, school pickup that is typically very, very busy with cars was definitely fewer and less traffic than it usually is. And people sort of wondering what happens next. There was a lot of questions, as Sam alluded to, about why were these people wearing masks? What, you know, that you know, why do they have to wear masks? And, you know, we shared something from, you know, sort of the official explanation from the Department of Homeland Security about why that is, which they say, you know, these law enforcement officers identify themselves as police while wearing masks to protect themselves from being targeted by known and suspected gang members, murderers, and rapists. So that was, you know, the sort of official explanation for why the masks, but I think it was still something that people really kind of questioned here and wondered why they need to wear masks and had not seen that type of thing before. So there was a lot of discussion about that. And yeah, I think just people, you know, the food pantry here put out a message and said, you know, we're, you know, sort of basically we're here for you if you need people to help get food to you. We, you know, we can help with that. There's, you know, sort of no questions asked. If you need to have someone come and get food from the food pantry and have it delivered and that kind of thing.
Mm. We're going to have to leave it here. There's still so much to talk about, and one feels like this story is not over at all. I just want to, before we go, put a plug in for you guys both work in very local newsrooms that are not really set up to respond to this kind of new breaking news, and both your papers and so many of the other local news entities did great job, like, jumping in and trying to understand what was happening and communicating to the communities what was happening on short notice and without a lot of information. So I want to say thank you to both of you. Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Sam, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current, great work. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on CAI. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. This spring, almost every Cape Cod town saw a ballot question asking the state to stop the evaporation of radioactive water from the Pilgrim nuclear plant. And as we are past the Memorial Day, summer is officially racing toward us. So how are some local businesses feeling about that prospect amid the uncertainties of the political climate? CAI's Jeanette Barnes has both those stories and joins us now. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Tell us about the ballot question that appeared, well, almost everywhere across the Cape.
Yes, this was on every town ballot on the Cape except in Barnstable. And that's just because Barnstable elections are in the fall, not the spring. It was also in the ballot on the ballot in Plymouth. And the question directed the towns to call upon state officials to stop the nuclear plant from evaporating this radioactive water. The plant originally had more than 1 million gallons of this water that has been held and used in various parts of the reactor system. The water's now down below 840,000 gallons because of evaporation into the outdoor air. Holtec, the company that owns the plant, says the water is treated, but that treatment cannot remove all contamination, especially with tritium, which is a radioactive form of hydrogen. And this ballot question did pass in all those towns.
And this water that's at the center of discussion, this is the same water that Holtec, the nuclear plant owner there, wants to dump into Cape Cod Bay. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So the state rejected a permit for Holtec to dump the water in liquid form. Holtec is appealing that, which is a lengthy process. But in the meantime, this water is evaporating, which emits whatever is in it into the air. As we know, local activists have been fighting this. Some are concerned about real health effects, they say, could happen from the radiation. Others are more concerned about the public perception and like what it could do to tourism and to the shellfish industry if if there's word of radioactive material release into the bay, whether it is in the water or in the air over the bay. And so there's a group of organizations like working as a coalition to fight this.
All right. No spoilers here, but this ballot question did not meet much resistance among voters.
No, it certainly did not. All of the towns approved it, and generally by overwhelming margins, like in the 80 to 90% range. In a way, if you read the ballot question and you take it at face value, it's not hard to see why that would happen. I mean, not all the wordings were identical of the questions, but most of them said that untreated water is evaporating from the nuclear plant and threatening public health. So, you know, who would want that? But Holtec, the company, says that wording's not accurate.
Well, talk about that a little bit more, because Holtec says the water should be considered safe, and it's pushed back against, you know, some of the assertions in that ballot question.
Right. The spokesman for the company, Patrick O'Brien, says that wording is false. He said that the radiation dose from that evaporation is just a tiny fraction of not only of what's legally allowed, but what Americans typically receive just from living in the world, from both from natural sources and human-made sources out in the world. We have some details on our website if people want to see those numbers. But part of the reason this really is such a tough issue is because both sides say that science is on their side. There's a member of the state panel on Pilgrim who is generally a Pilgrim or Holtec supporter, you might say, who has a sticker on her laptop that says something like, "Science doesn't care what you believe." But the activists who are concerned about the health risks from Pilgrim cite other scientists who say there is no provable safe level of radiation exposure for human health. So we have a science debate on our hands here.
So all of these towns approved a ballot question asking the state to halt this evaporation, but it's a non-binding question. So what does that really mean, and what happens next?
Yeah, this is important to understand about this ballot question. It's non-binding, which means it's asking towns to do something, but they don't really have to do anything except to just report election results to the state as they would with any election. For a town to actually do what the question is asking, that would probably involve the select board like taking an active role in calling upon the state to stop the evaporation. The activists have decided not to wait for that to happen. They may be putting pressure on select boards to do that in some towns. But for now, their plan is to kind of take this win, which was a big win at the ballot box, and to hand deliver documentation of those votes to state officials, mainly to Governor Healey's office. They tell me they have not been granted a private meeting with her to do that, but they do plan to drop off the documents.
Okay, let's talk about the summer outlook for local businesses. Summer is the backbone and the lifeblood of the Cape economy. And businesses here, we know, are dependent on things like visa workers and foreign tourists. Give us a broad sense of concerns as you reached out to business owners.
Sure. I would say easily the biggest concern that people are citing this year is just the overall sense of volatility in the business climate. They always have to wait a little bit for those worker visas to come through, but some of them say it has taken a bit longer than usual to get the visas approved. We have the off again, on again situation with the tariffs. And people are saying, at least anecdotally on the Cape, that Canadian tourists have canceled their reservations because of the tariffs, and of course, because of President Trump saying repeatedly that Canada should be a U.S. state.
You reached out to a couple of business owners to find out how they're feeling in this moment heading into summer. I want to hear about some specifics, I guess. What's the situation like from the folks that you spoke to?
Yes, one business owner I talked to was Mac Hay of Mac Seafood, which has five restaurants on the Cape plus fish markets. And he said that it's not unusual for one of the things that could kind of really mess them up to like be up in the air at the beginning of the season, whether it's visas or something else. But it seems like this year everything is up in the air or feels volatile. He does not pay much in tariffs for the seafood that he sells here on the Cape because most of those are US products. But what he does do is he exports a significant amount of lobster, mainly to China and Europe. And so he said the tariffs, both on China and from China, there in that trade war, basically stopped that trade for weeks. He said Canada was undercutting lobster prices in the US during that time. And one thing he feels like people don't always appreciate is that if the tariffs are lifted, it's not just like turning the faucet back on. He says, it takes some time for markets to ramp up again and for him to start selling. He said that export business of lobsters for him is down at least 40% for this calendar year. Just one quick thing, though, on the positive side, right before we talked, he got word that his visa workers, his foreign workers, had their visas approved.
What about the idea that Canadians might not be visiting the Cape this summer? Talk about that a moment.
Yeah, so people are talking about cancellations. They say that some Canadians have canceled, especially if those are refundable reservations, right? Some people have non-refundable reservations. But that issue also is borne out in some of the national news reporting saying that Canadians are planning to go elsewhere for vacation or cancel their American trips. Both of the business owners I talked with and Senator Julian Scheer as well mentioned this issue of Canadian travelers. They are significant on the Cape. And they say that especially in September and into the fall, when American kids are back in school, a lot of American tourists are gone. That's when the Cape kind of relies on travelers from Canada and from Europe to round out the season. So that's kind of on their minds, like what will things be like in September?
I have 1 minute here, but I want to ask you about the other local business that you spoke with. Tell us about them and how they see things.
Sure, yes. I talked with Shayna Ferrullo, who owns Snowy Owl Coffee Roasters. She is concerned about the volatility as well. She said she recently had to raise her prices, which was not because of tariffs, but because of the changes in the market for green coffee. That's the unroasted coffee she buys. But she said she learned a lot in the pandemic about how a small thing, like a disruption in the supply chain, can really cause a huge disruption. Like in the pandemic, at one point she couldn't get the correct size of coffee cup for one of the coffees on her menu, which affects the pricing then because you're changing the size and everything. So she is concerned about the volatility.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
Students at Nauset Regional High School are expressing concern over the unexplained reassignment of a favorite teacher. Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle has some more details and joins us now. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Steve.
At a school committee meeting last week, there was a large turnout from Nauset High students. They were in support of the school's drama teacher. There's a lot we don't know here, but tell us what we do know.
Sure. So Ian Hamilton is the head of the drama department at Nauset Regional High School. He is at the end of his current 3-year probationary contract. And right before the school committee meeting on May 22nd, the day before, Hamilton notified his students and members of the Nauset Drama Club, the Nauset players, that he would not be returning as to lead the drama program. That sparked some immediate concern among students and parents associated with the program. A number of students showed up to the school committee meeting and spoke during public comment for the better part of 45 minutes just to state their case. And they raised a wide number of issues, not only about their, support for their teacher and about, the safe inclusionary space he's helped create, for his students, but also really more broadly, the state of arts, the state of drama in the district and the administration's support for it going forward. So it was really quite, quite a turnout last week.
You have some of the anecdotal testimony included in the piece that you have here. Talk about a couple of the specific things that students cited here.
Yeah, I think the common thread was just the care and sort of understanding that Mr. Hamilton sort of brought into his classroom, how he made everyone feel comfortable, made everyone feel safe, made everyone feel welcome. There was testimony from other students, who had talked about, when they arrived at the school, it was through the drama department that they found their place, their community. One student talked about moving here what was only supposed to be a temporary basis, from Los Angeles, and ended up, pleading with her family for them to stay because of the connection she made through the drama program and her fellow students. Really, the case was just made that they thought it was unfair that what they saw as a teacher who really goes above and beyond to make connections with his students, to let them know that they're heard, that they're respected, that caliber of teachers is, the kind of teacher that the department or the administration would choose not to bring back. Although it should be clear, he will be there next year, just in a different role.
Well, that is kind of an open question then, right? Because tell us a little bit more about what the school district itself is saying, the superintendent, Brooke Clenchey, because they're bringing Mr. Hamilton back, but not giving him the role that he was now, and also not... They haven't talked about what that new role will be. Do they have any information about why this decision's being made and what the vision is for his role at the school going forward?
And I think that's part of the frustration, because no, we don't. It can get to be a thorny issue when it relates to personnel matters. Administration is typically very reluctant and in a lot of cases legally bound not to go into details when it relates to personnel matters. So we do not have any clarity about, you know, what his new role will be, who will be brought in, you know, to lead the drama program in his absence. And I think that's part of the frustration is, you know, the students and parents and those close to the program want some assurances. They want some answers to know how did they arrive at this decision, why, and what are the next steps. It got to the point where one student sort of pressed the school committee last week to say, can you bring this up on the agenda for your next meeting? And the school committee was noncommittal about that. They sort of deferred back to the administration saying personnel issues are administrative matters, not those of the school committee. So that is a big gray area that, you know, some clarity is still needed there in terms of, you know, how do things proceed.
That is Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. Stay with us. .com
and the Cape Cod Foundation, committed to building resources.
This is the Local News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. Provincetown made headlines across the country and even internationally this week. It wasn't the kind of press anybody would want, but it was a public health precaution. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent can explain. He joins us now. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Steve.
A news alert went out on Saturday, which got broadcast far and wide. A food service worker in town had been diagnosed with hepatitis A. The Department of Public Health moved really quickly and robustly to get the word out here.
Yes, they sent out a press release that goes statewide, and then it gets picked up by affiliates. So, you know, ABC, CBS, NBC, all of their affiliates across the country picked it up, and even in London. That said that a food worker had been infected with hepatitis A, and then warned about ways in which it can be transmitted through contaminated food, through food handling, and warned people who had eaten at the restaurant, the Red Inn in Provincetown, that they might want to talk to their doctor about their vaccination status because there was still time to be vaccinated against hepatitis A to prevent an infection.
I think for a lot of us, this was kind of an educational moment, too, not knowing a lot about hepatitis A and why there was such a robust and strong response to get this alert out. Can you talk a little bit about what we learned about hepatitis A?
Yes, it's very rare in the United States. It does circulate much more widely in some overseas places. It can be transmitted through sexual contact, through food handling. If you eat the wrong burrito on the wrong beach, you can get hepatitis A. So it can spread fairly easily, but it's very rare in the United States. There were about two cases here this year, one case last year, one case the year before. Some years there are zero cases on Cape Cod, that kind of a thing.
And the folks who put out this alert were also pretty quick to say that there was no indication that this was related to the restaurant itself. The person who was a food service worker at the restaurant happened to contract this, but it's almost certainly not related to what's going on at the restaurant.
The town was very quick to say that. So the town health department had a press release that said, you know, we don't think this is a facilities issue. We don't think this happened here at the restaurant. We think more or less someone came to work. And because there's 2 weeks in which you don't have symptoms but could be contagious, there's about 2 weeks in which, you know, transmission could have taken place. The state release was not as clear about believing that the case had not been through contamination at the Red Inn. The state release was sort of shorter, more terse, and just had basic, you know, this is how you contact your doctor stuff. So the town was trying to communicate, hey, just so you know, we don't think this is a restaurant issue. We think somebody got sick somewhere. And the state was a little less clear about that.
You reached out to the folks at the Red Inn. Nobody wants to have this happen at their business, and especially as they're heading into summer.
Right. Obviously, it did get – they were getting messages from friends all over the country who had seen it on TV, people in Nashville, people in San Francisco, people in New York City. So, as they said, you know, a lot of people do – people who've traveled widely sort of know that hepatitis A is common overseas. It's a shot you get before you travel. They kind of were able to do the math, like, oh, this probably happened, you know, while people were on their seasonal vacations overseas. But again, a lot of the press was not as clear about that, and so you had the idea of contaminated food circulating on CBS channels, whereas actually what the town was saying was, well, no, this really is just someone who came to work with an illness that they got, and these are the precautions we take when that happens.
I want to ask about what we know about the health of I guess, the person who got this and the fellow employees there at the Red Inn.
That person is okay. They'll be coming back to work when they're medically cleared. It is an infection that normally can clear even without treatment. The body does deal with it. It's a serious infection while you have it, and it can be serious for certain people with certain conditions. But it is not typically the kind of thing that is life-threatening. It is the case that you want to be vaccinated for it. Most of the staff at that restaurant were already vaccinated for it. And public health is, if you want to go back to work and we think that you've worked alongside this person, you need to get the vaccine to prevent you from getting sick. So the rest of the staff, about five or six people, did get that vaccine so that they could go back to work.
Is it a readily available vaccine? Do we know? I mean, for people who had come into contact with this at the restaurant, potentially, who went to see their doctors, is it something they were able to get?
Yes. The county has vaccine clinics every Tuesday and Thursday at the county building, and there's going to be a vaccine clinic here in Provincetown coming up on June 18th. Also, Outer Cape Health Services had enough of it. The county had enough of it on hand to vaccinate the workers who needed it, and there's going to be another vaccine clinic coming so that, you know, anyone who's watched this and been like, wow, I'd rather not go through this experience, can get the hepatitis A vaccine coming up in Provincetown.
And Paul, as far as we know, nobody has responded nobody's been diagnosed, I guess, with hepatitis A, having come in contact with this particular instance.
Yes, the authorities were able to explain that there's not a preceding case on Cape Cod connected, right? So they don't think the person got it on Cape Cod because there's not a preceding case. There's also not a following case at this point. There's not any indication that there has been spread from this person to anyone else as of, you know, yesterday, which is when the health director sent the most recent update that we have.
It's Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Governor Healey speaks out on federal immigration actions across the Commonwealth, and dozens of state business regulations are being cut in the hopes of making life easier for local companies. Our Statehouse reporter Katie Lannon has the week's news from Beacon Hill. Hi, Katie.
Hey there. Good to be with you.
Katie, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, what's known as ICE, had a major action on Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket this week, detaining dozens of people, providing almost no details about the arrests. The governor was asked about this specifically, and she had some strong words.
Yeah, she's really keying in on the fact, too, that, as you say, there aren't a lot of details available. She says state and local law enforcement got zero information about the federal operations, that she only heard about two people with alleged criminal records. And she says this is part of the problem with ICE across the country. Due process concerns the governor has been repeatedly raising about immigration actions here in Massachusetts. And she says it's creating fear and anxiety in the communities, and that that's not what she thinks is supposed to be happening. Federal immigration enforcement officials are, of course, touting the public safety concerns that they said led to this operation.
Let's talk a little bit about healthcare. Governor Mara Healey says healthcare cuts approved by the U.S. House could have a devastating impact on the Commonwealth if they pass. What is she pointing to here?
Yeah, this is another issue where policymakers here on Beacon Hill once again have their eye on federal action, as Republicans in Congress are moving ahead with a package that would cut spending on Medicaid. MassHealth, the Medicaid program here, is a major player. It supports nearly half of the state's children, almost three quarters of nursing home residents, and more than half of people with disabilities. So Healey says that if the legislation that's already passed the U.S. House does go through the Senate as well, Massachusetts would lose over $1 billion in federal funding, and 250,000 people would lose their health insurance through MassHealth and the Health Connector marketplace. And that, she says, has broader ramifications because hospitals and nursing homes rely on that Medicaid revenue. So if they can't pay their bills, they'll close for everyone, not just Medicaid patients.
A busy week for the governor. The governor also spoke out about the wider impacts of the Trump administration going after Harvard, essentially saying that this isn't necessarily just about one institution here.
Yeah, she was pretty blunt about the Trump administration's actions against Harvard. She calls it stupid. She says that it's a question of really international competitiveness if the United States becomes less welcoming to foreign students, because she says, as she sees it, it's China who will win this race. And, you know, she's spoken so far that she's seen or heard stories, at least, of Chinese academics recruiting on Massachusetts campuses. So this is a more of the same thread that the governor has been trying to bring attention to so far.
Katie, each week we've been checking on the state budget process. There's a deadline that the legislature is nominally working against here. What's the latest?
Yeah, that's a July 1 deadline to have a budget in place that Massachusetts usually misses and has temporary spending bills to keep government running. Negotiations are formally kicking off this week on the $61 billion state budget, but negotiators are still waiting to see what the federal government is going to do. So they're forging ahead in these negotiations while counting on a certain amount of money, about $16 billion from the federal government, that they don't know if that will all materialize. So even if they do reach a budget deal before that July 1st deadline, they might have to come back later and make additional cuts, or the governor, who will have the power to do so once the budget is signed into law, might have to make those cuts.
Hmm. Finally, the Healey administration is scrapping dozens of state business regulations in the hopes of making life easier for Massachusetts companies. This is interesting. Explain this for us.
Yeah, this is the result of something Healey announced in her State of the State speech at the start of the year, a review of business regulations from the state office in charge of that. And she said that the ones they're scrapping are requirements that can impose challenges. Think banks and insurance companies having to file on paper or computer disks. I mean, when was the last time you saw a computer disk? Striped barber poles are actually required under state regulations at barber shops. So that would be done away with under this plan. The requirement that grocery stores individually price their items with orange stickers. These are things that the governor's tackling that she says add costs for consumers. And, you know, it's worth noting that we are going to be thinking about an election year where we have Republican candidates running against the Democratic Governor Maura Healey, who will be appealing to businesses and trying to make the case that they'll be a more business-friendly chief executive.
That is our State House reporter, Katie Lannon. Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The town of Falmouth is dealing with the discovery that its youth baseball fields were built atop a lot of contaminated soil. Now the town is working toward a solution to make the fields playable again. CAI's Gilda Geist has an update. Hi, Gilda.
Hey, Steve.
The town held a public meeting to share new information on the extent of this contamination. Tell us about the meeting and this discussion.
Yeah, so the meeting was at the Lawrence School last week, and among the speakers were some consultants from a firm the town hired to, like, look into the contamination, figure out the full extent of things. So one consultant, James Luker, gave a breakdown of the chemicals they found. Those materials included glass, arsenic, PCBs, to name a few, but lead was the primary contaminant. And so Luker explained that many of these harmful materials were basically abundant or concentrated enough that the town is legally required to report it to the state and get it cleaned up, which the town has already reported it and is already in the process of getting it cleaned up.
Explain a little bit more about why the fields here are contaminated and why it took so long for this to become apparent.
Yes. So last fall, the town was having some new lights installed at the field. And during the installation, they noticed some kind of strange materials in the soil. So they did some testing and some research, and it turns out that the baseball fields were built on top of an old municipal landfill. And so the materials from that landfill were making their way to the surface and contaminating the soil. As for why no one noticed earlier, it kind of seems like it was just pure accident that people noticed at all. This landfill was active in the 1950s, and so probably very few, if any, town employees now were around to remember that. So, you know, back when the fields opened in the 70s, it was a very different time. We knew a lot less about some of these chemicals and their long-term effects. State regulations were also more lenient. So back then, people may not have even realized that the fact that these fields were built on top of a landfill would one day become an issue.
So one of the concerns now is whether this contamination, now that it's been discovered, could be a threat to the town's water supply.
Yeah, so the fields are by Long Pond. That's the closest water source to the fields, and it's a big one for the town. So yeah, people were worried that the contamination had gotten into the pond. So that consultant, James Luker, he said the pond had been tested. They tested the pond, actually, and the contaminants found in the baseball field soil were not present in the pond. And also, he said it looked like the groundwater, the way that it flows from the fields, is away from the pond, not toward it. So
these fields get a lot of use as part of the town youth athletics program. The town wants to get them back into play. It's proposing a couple of different options here.
Yeah, so the director of the Department of Public Works, Peter McConerty, he was at the meeting, and he kind of presented the two options for how the town could move forward. So both of these options have something in common, and that's using what's called a geotextile membrane. So this is a type of physical barrier that's used in construction for all different purposes. But in this case, the geotextile membrane would be there to be a physical barrier, to prevent material from the old landfill from coming up to the surface. So McConerty said option one, putting down the geotextile membrane, adding 2 feet of fill material, then putting a grass field on top. And then the other option involves adding only 1 foot of fill on top of that membrane and then adding artificial turf on top. So it's worth noting here, I think, that several people at the meeting were against the artificial turf option. Artificial turf often contains its own harmful chemicals such as PFAS, so that's already part of the conversation. But which option the town goes with also depends on factors like funding. So no matter which option, McConerty estimated that the fields could be ready for play by fall 2027. Falmouth Town Meeting voters could weigh in on funding for the new fields as soon as this fall.
Okay, let's talk about another story you covered. The Kituat Center for the Arts has a special new exhibit opening. You spoke with one of the curators, Paula Peters. The exhibit focuses on art of the Wampanoag Nation. Tell us more.
Yeah, so this exhibit is called All Our Relations, Art of the Wampanoag Nation, and it features art from more than 20 Wampanoag artists of all different ages, genres, and tribes. There's work from Maquinna Wampanoags, Mashpee Wampanoags, Herring Pond Wampanoags, probably more. There's pottery, there's paintings, digital art, beadwork. It's a really interesting, diverse group of artwork with the one unifying theme of being inspired by or informed by the artist's Wampanoag heritage.
So you got a chance to see some of this artwork. You went to visit. Tell us about some of the pieces.
Yes. So I was at Paula's house for this one. And some of the art that's going to be in the exhibit is actually hers and hangs in her house. One is this painting by her brother, Robert Peters. It's in this kind of cubist looking style. It's of a wolf howling at the moon. Very haunting, kind of modern 3D surreal vibes. And then there are some very traditional pieces where the artists research the kinds of techniques and patterns and symbols that their ancestors would have used to make things like pottery and regalia. Ramona Peters has a pottery piece in the show. She's a Mashpee Wampanoag potter. And so it looks like a vase. And then the top part of the vase has these kind of etchings. And those etchings mimic those found on Wampanoag pottery pieces that have been found in archaeological digs. Mm. And then there's some really modern stuff, like this digital artwork made by Herring Pond Wampanoag Quincy Harding. She has these really moving illustrations that focus on missing, murdered Indigenous women. There's the, you know, the red handprint motif. For those who don't know, this refers to the phenomenon in which Indigenous women are victims of violent crimes at disproportionate rates. So her work incorporates that motif, very moving. And then finally, I'll leave everything else. You'll have to go see it in person. But the last thing I'll mention is there's the wampum belt, which is kind of, it's quite a sight to behold. Paula says it's probably the largest contemporary wampum art piece around. Over 100 Wampanoags worked on it, from shaping the beads to weighing in on the design to actually weaving the whole thing together. It's pretty cool.
There are multiple dimensions to this project as well, including performances.
Yes, there are so many performances planned for the month that this exhibit is open. This includes Anawan Whedon's one-man show, First Light Flashback, which is, like, such a beloved show. I've only heard amazing things about it. That's one of the first performances they're having. There will also be musical performances, a Juneteenth solidarity event, so much more. Folks can find all the info at Kituat.org.
That is CAI's Gilda Geist. Gilda, thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. Big thanks to all our guests. A lot of news to cover this week. And thank you to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. Dan Treidel, blood type, radio positive. That's all we've got. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. We'll talk to you next week.